gotcha. You thought I didn't see you now, didn't you? You try to sneak by me now, didn't you? Now give me what you promised me. Give it, yeah.
Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's the last day of March, the 31st, a Thursday, and I've got news and comment for you.
You promised me the day that you quit your boyfriend.
The irrepressible Joe Tex opens the podcast today. The tune is called I Gotcha. And Donald Trump stepped into a big trap on MSDNC yesterday. And I can't prove that it was orchestrated, scripted, but it sure came off that way. The network was busy. They had an exclusive interview with Hillary Clinton that Rachel Maddow conducted at the famous Apollo Theater in Harlem. They had an interview with Bernie Sanders. Chris Matthews was assigned the task of interviewing Donald Trump. And I couldn't watch all night, but I think there was more. I think there was even a Kasich interview. But the pivotal part was that Chris Matthews really grilled Donald Trump about abortion issues. And Trump was not prepared. And Chris Matthews can be a very challenging interview. He is high-pressured, he peppers you with questions, and he interrupts relentlessly. And he really nailed Trump. He backed him into a corner where Trump said, well, I guess, yeah, I would want penalties for a woman who has an abortion once I succeed in banning it. And that's the soundbite that got played all night long on MSDNC. Now, Trump has walked it back, which is going to infuriate everybody, whether they're pro-life, pro-choice, or in the middle somewhere. But I think it was a gotcha moment. I think that Chris Matthews knew that he could corner Trump on this and that Trump could not come up with good answers. And he's infuriated the pro-life activists who have made so much progress toward their goal of banning abortion by not addressing issues like criminalizing a woman who seeks or obtains an abortion. They don't want to touch that. But when you look at the outlines of it, it's interesting. I mentioned that Maddow went into detail of how she conducted her first interview with Clinton at the Apollo Theater somewhere early in the day. And then after she learned of the exchange between Matthews and Trump, she rushed over to Hillary's headquarters in Brooklyn and taped a second interview to tee up the Clinton campaign for a very strong and effective reaction to the blunders that Donald Trump inflicted on himself. And this could be one of those pivotal moments. Remember Todd Akin? He was appearing on a local TV show in St. Louis. He was being interviewed by C.D. Jaco, who is a friend of mine. And Jaco just asked him, about the lack of any exceptions to the rape policy embraced by Congressman Akin. And that's where he made his comment about legitimate rape. And at that point, his campaign was over. Now, for Trump, this is a really complicated issue because most Republicans don't believe that he's really pro-life and that he really will try to ban abortion. He didn't attempt to answer Matthew's question about how he would ban abortion. He just made it seem like it's going to happen because I'm Donald Trump. But by first suggesting that he would criminalize the woman and then walking that back and saying, no, only the evil doctors would be subject to criminal penalties. Well, it's a mess. And I have no sympathy for Trump. But one of the interesting things is that in between the two interviews, and after Rachel Maddow learned what Trump said in response to Matthew's questions, she contacted Bernie Sanders. And we didn't see any tape or any evidence of their conversation. She simply said that while he was outraged by this remark, that it seemed like a gotcha It seemed like this is just another one of those campaign tricks, and Sanders didn't want to go there. He wanted to talk about the real issues. Now, I think that is the correct answer. But it gave an opening to Hillary Clinton, and she took it. And very effectively kind of marginalized Sanders, saying he simply doesn't understand these issues. And so was this a calculated move by MSNBC to buttress the Clinton campaign, pivot to the fall, attack Trump, weaken him among the core groups that support Hillary Clinton? I don't know, but it sure looked like it to me. And we will see how all of this plays out. And I'm just looking at my notes here to see if there's anything I wanted to add. Wisconsin, of course, is the primary next week. And Scott Walker, he's the governor there who they attempted to recall and failed. And he, of course, signed a bill banning abortions after 20 weeks of pregnancy. And he has embraced, just this week, endorsed Ted Cruz. And, you know, they're all hardliners about the abortion issue. They don't believe in any exceptions, and it is really just remarkable how out of touch they are about this issue, and they continue to believe that the positions that win them votes in the Republican primaries will play across the general electorate, and I think that is a big mistake. Here's a quote in the New York Times from Jean Mancini, president of the March for Life Education and Defense Fund. No pro-lifer would ever want to punish a woman who has chosen abortion. We invite a woman who has gone down this route to consider paths to healing, not punishment. They know that that is a toxic position, and they want to get as far away from it as they can. The Los Angeles Times today released a report based on an investigation that they teamed up with the investigative reporting program at the University of California, Berkeley's Journalism School. And they investigated the folks who concocted those videos that were used to demonize Planned Parenthood and lead to the hysterical campaign to defund it. And we're learning more about the way those videos were assembled. And the guy who drove the whole effort, David Daleiden, I think that's how his name is pronounced, he's only 27 years old, but he is a savvy propagandist. And the Times article shows, for example, how he carefully coached one of the people who appeared in a video, a woman named Holly O'Donnell. Let's try it two more times. And she said, I don't want to tell that story again. Please don't make me again, David. But he kept coaching her until she delivered the information or the commentary that he was looking for. And while Daleiden claims that they were acting as investigative journalism, this investigation concludes that the activist methods were geared more toward political provocation than journalism. The videos and the court records show that Daleiden and his colleagues, posing as representatives of a fetal tissue brokerage, tried to loosen the tongues of abortion providers with alcohol. And we know that a Houston grand jury that had been asked to indict Planned Parenthood instead indicted Daleiden and Sandra Merritt, one of his co-conspirators. And the charges are pretty flimsy. They're tampering with government records because they used fake California driver's licenses to create fake identities when they went so-called undercover. Daleiden says, engaging a necessity defense, that he can break confidentiality agreements that he signed to gain entry to some of these meetings because he is trying to prevent murder. But Judge William Orrick here in San Francisco, who has presided over this case, he has watched all the videos, more than 500 hours. Oh, God, poor guy. And he says that the videos have not been pieces of journalistic integrity, but misleadingly edited videos and unfounded assertions of criminal conduct. Daleiden's fraud was so extensive and his videos so misleading that his still unpublished recordings do not warrant First Amendment protection, says the judge. And in his order, he used the words fraud or fraudulently 13 times in referring to Daleiden's methods. And Dalyden was honest, behind the scenes, that he was trying to provoke congressional hearings or investigations and political consequences. So Sandra Merritt, again, one of his co-conspirators, went along on one of these hidden camera events, and they tried to get their interview subject, who worked in the abortion business, to drink a lot of wine. But the target refused, and Sandra Merritt joked that she had drunk most of the wine herself and that she was too drunk to read a message on her phone, on a phone, when she was leaving that meeting. And also, Merritt was coached on how to deliver her lines, just like other people. There's another case of a woman named O'Donnell, a former technician for STEM Express. And she's being coached, and they show that in one of the takes she said, "I got into the medical field because I wanted to help people, not steal fetal tissues." But after she's been coached, she says, "I got into the medical field to try to help people, not to steal dead baby parts and sell them." So we can see the calculation that went into the effort to take down Planned Parenthood around the phony claims that they were selling fetal tissues. And yesterday I mentioned that the Food and Drug Administration has relaxed the protocols for the prescription drug that causes abortion called, Mifepristone or something like that. RU486 was the working name that I can remember. At any rate, there's a new test, a pilot project in the states of New York, Hawaii, Oregon, and Washington that will permit women to access an abortion pill by mail. And the way it would work is that first meetings with a doctor would be conducted by a video conference. And they said that the women would be able to get testing like blood tests and ultrasounds where they are required at clinics that don't provide abortion. And then they can conduct the counseling part of it, get the prescription over the internet, and have it mailed to them. And I think that that is a great development that can take the wind out of the sails of the anti-abortion movement. More on the presidential campaign. Bernie Sanders, at least for now, is not on the ballot for the Washington, D.C. primary, which comes up in mid-June, on the 14th of June. They are blaming a clerical error on the part of the D.C. Democratic Party, and they submitted the application a day late. It's not clear why the paperwork wouldn't have included both Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. Both paid the fee and met the internal deadlines, but then the party managed to drop the ball as related to Sanders. I'm linking to Nate Silver's latest analysis at 5:38. About the challenge that Bernie Sanders faces. And I think it's important for people like me who support him to have a reality check. And while it is mathematically possible for him to win the pledged delegates, we're putting the superdelegates aside, it is very much an uphill climb. And he needs some rousing, huge, huge victories, like Wisconsin, like New York. But, for example, in New York, he trails Clinton by something like 20 points. Here in California, he's closing the gap. But those two states are the biggest with biggest remaining states with large blocks of delegates. And so I'm going to link to this, and you can read it for yourself. But Nate Silver says, for example, that based on his calculations, that Sanders needs to win California by 15 points, by 15%. He needs to win New York by 4, Pennsylvania by 7, New Jersey by 6, Maryland by 9. Those are generally achievable, although the California number will require still more work. The election is not until June 7th. But when you get to states like Oregon, Nate Silver calculates that Sanders needs to win by 48%, a wallop like he achieved in the caucuses in neighboring Washington state. So it is still mathematically possible. But as I have maintained from the start, a few things need to break Bernie's way, and some of it relates to Hillary Clinton's vulnerabilities over the email and server and the ongoing investigation, and when we might see a result from that. And I do think that Clinton gave the right answer. Rachel Maddow pressed her on some process issues, but didn't ask her anything, for example, about the emails or about Syria or about Libya or about Honduras or the things that, you know, I was screaming at the TV that she should talk about. But when she asked Clinton about whether Sanders should get out now, Hillary gave the right answer. She said, look, I didn't get out in 2008, and so I'm not going to advise Bernie to do that now. Of course, her campaign and all her surrogates are putting on that pressure, but she, of course, rises above all that and is able to offer that kind of magnanimous position. I'm also linking to a piece that I picked up from CalBuzz today, written by Harold Meyerson at the American Prospect. And I don't agree with his premature political obituary for the presidential campaign of Bernie Sanders. But Meyerson makes some really important points, that win or lose, that Sanders has conducted a political campaign that will be a wave campaign that will have an impact for cycles to come. And he says that the only one you can compare it to is Barry Goldwater's 1964 campaign, where he didn't come close to winning, but he launched the conservative movement that we're still wrestling with today. And if Bernie Sanders is successful in that effort, that could be his signature development and what we remember him for. There is a planned People's Summit in Chicago in mid-June where Meyerson says the disparate groups in the Sanders universe will gather to lay out a common agenda. Some are planning how to prod the delegates at the Democratic Convention to shift the party well to the left. And the other big takeaway from this lengthy piece is that Meyerson points out that Bernie Sanders has made socialism respectable in the United States. He goes back to 1906 when, you know, the campaigns of alleged or honest out socialists got only about 6% of the vote. But he said, the Des Moines Register poll on the eve of the Iowa caucuses, 43% of likely Democratic caucus attendees said they were socialists. A Boston Globe poll on the eve of the New Hampshire primary, 31% of Democratic voters called themselves socialists. Among voters under 35, over half said they are socialists. In South Carolina, a Bloomberg poll of likely Democratic voters showed that 39% described themselves as socialists. Now, on the right, it is still a reliable depth charge. You tag Obamacare as socialism, the president's called a socialist, he's not even a liberal. But that's the way the game works these days. And today, I'm releasing an interesting, entertaining, and informative interview with my friend Thomas Frank to my listeners at peterbcollins.com, iTunes, TuneIn, and everywhere else that you get the podcast. Tom Frank dropped by the Secret Studio yesterday to talk about his new book, Listen Liberal. And Frank really nails it because he really shows the long arc of the changes in the Democratic Party, how they have dropped their commitment to the working class and embraced the professional class. And the way I characterize it is the Democrats have solidified their position as the number two corporate party in this country. But in this excerpt, Tom Frank makes the clear argument that while Democratic leadership keeps saying that the way to win is to move to the right, that the real formula for victory is to move to the left.
They look at the two parties. You've got a party of the right and you've got a party of the left. And so the median voter is, by definition, Mr. Collins, in between. Mm-hmm. And so the party of the left can only win that median voter and hence beat the other party by moving to the right. And vice versa is also true. And it works in that's the theory, mm-hmm. and reality doesn't matter. The theory is – it's like a platonic ideal of politics, and nothing else matters. Now, here's what I've been saying for the last 20 years. No, that's not the swing voter. The swing voter mm-hmm. is white working class people who've grown disgusted with the Democrats and have been brought over to the Republicans by culture war issues or dog whistle politics or all of these other things. Mm-hmm. And the only way that the Democrats are going to win them back is not by moving to the right, but paradoxically by moving to the left on economic issues, because that's why they were Democrats in the first place. And Peter...
And not to jump the timeline here,
this is
Tom,
what's happening now. It's come back to bite us in the ass.
But this is the one year where a lefty like Sanders could maneuver through the mess and win.
Yeah. Oh,
mainly
no,
because
no doubt,
the Republicans
no doubt.
Are in shambles.
Yes, but look at what's
and
happening.
And because of his appeal beyond the Democratic base to independent voters, which Hillary does not have.
Yep. That's exactly right. But anyhow, Democrats, by the way, refuse to acknowledge this theory. You know, it's just they laugh it out. It can't mm-hmm. be can't be true.
Mm-hmm.
And every year it gets a little worse because, of course, it is true. Look at Trump. Yeah. Look at what's happening. Who are those people voting for him? They're former Democrats.
You can hear the full interview with Thomas Frank about his new book, Listen Liberal. It's available today for subscribers at peterbcollins.com and all of our outlets. And I want to thank subscribers who support my work. Mark Shapiro is back. He was a subscriber before. I'm not sure what happened, but he just signed up for a new annual subscription. Thank you, Mark. Monthly subscribers Kathleen Lowy, Mona Kobus, and Anna Gordonier are putting in their money right on time via PayPal. And I'm grateful to these supporters. I'd like you to join them. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click on menu, then you click on the pull down that says become a subscriber. You can choose $5, $10, $20 a month. Our best deal is that $50 annual subscription because it earns you a bonus gift. Like John Perkins, New Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Like Joe Hickman, The Burn Pits. Like Ben Parker's Field Guide to the F Word. I'd love to send one of those books to you. Just take out a new annual subscription and give me an address in the continental United States and give me a little time and you'll get it. Well, I have two stories today about the protesters who were drawn to Donald Trump rallies. And the New York Times profiled a group of 10 liberals or lefties in Janesville, Wisconsin. That, of course, is where Trump held a rally on Tuesday to piss off the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, who's from Janesville. And they talk about how these 10 people had a meeting, tried to figure out the best way to approach, getting into the venue and successfully protesting without making Trump look better. One of the protesters, 54-year-old Greg Galimbuk, said, "I think disrupting, shutting down his speech actually helps him." And so what the article does is it profiles these people. Most of them were turned away when they tried to enter the rally. And I really question whether you can control a political event like this and say that I'm turning you away because you look like a protester or your T-shirt doesn't agree with what Trump says. I really think that this is a violation of their First Amendment rights, but nobody else appears to be concerned about that. At any rate, I think it's interesting. Ultimately, only one of the 10 people got in because they staged a protest at the Holiday Inn Express, where five or six of them did the usual thing where they linked arms, put tubes over them, and then refused to leave. After about 4 hours, the cops did remove them. So one guy actually got into the rally hall, and he pulled out two banners from his jeans, and then he got grabbed and removed from the hall. But ABC News reported yesterday that a man from Arizona, nearby Phoenix, says that he was paid to protest at a Trump rally a week ago Saturday. The guy's name is Paul Horner, age 37. "I was given $3,500 to protest the rally in Fountain Hills, Arizona." He had answered a Craigslist ad looking for a group needing actors for a political event. He said, "As for those people, as for who those people were affiliated with that interviewed me, my guess would be Hillary Clinton." He said, "The actual check I received after I was done with the job was from a group called Women Are the Future. After I was hired, they told me if anyone asked any questions about who I was or communicated with me in any way, I should start talking about how great Bernie Sanders is. It was mostly women in their 60s at the interview I went to. Plus, all the people I communicated with had AOL email addresses." No one still has an AOL email address except people who would vote for Hillary Clinton. He also said, "Almost all the people I was protesting with, I had seen at my interview and training class. After talking to some of them, I learned that they only paid Latinos $500, Muslims $600, and African Americans a little more than that. Women and children were paid half of what the men got. Illegals received $300 across the board. Wow. That is a pay scale that is racist and sexist and not very progressive. And finally, the ABC article quotes a woman named Sarah Bradley, who she runs a nonprofit that provides the homeless people with brand new socks. And she said, "I'll protest that guy for free. Trump is creating a place for like-minded, hate-filled individuals to gather. You wouldn't have to pay me anything to protest that." Well, I don't know who paid that guy, but it does seem to lead to people affiliated with Hillary. The Defense Department has, as Congress requires it to do now, provided notice that it's going to release up to a dozen more prisoners from Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. This would occur about 30 days from now, and we don't have any details on which men will be selected to be released, but it's interesting that in the fourth paragraph of this account from the New York Times, it reads, "The government official was granted anonymity to discuss the plan because the administration does not officially confirm the transfers of prisoners before they occur." Well, this is a violation of the Times' new Titan policy on not accepting anonymous quotes, not accepting information from government officials who will not permit themselves to be identified. Well, that's a policy that didn't last very long. Yesterday, I took a swipe at President Obama for being so chintzy with paroles and pardons. And yesterday, I don't think he heard me, but he commuted the sentences of 61 more people convicted of federal drug and firearm crimes, and more than a third of those, or 20 people, were serving life in prison. Well, that's great news for those 61 people. There are only 10,000 more clemency applications that are in the pipeline. And he's going to have to work very quickly to get this backlog resolved before next January 20th. And as we told you yesterday, the previous director of the Pardon Office at the Justice Department, Deborah Leff, quit in disgust in January, saying, "I'm unable to carry out my job effectively." And now the new guy comes in there and has this 10,000 case backlog. Well, I hope they resolve it and we find justice for many of those who've made the application. And I hope there's no commutation or pardon for the current governor of Alabama, because it's overdue for the last Democratic governor of Alabama, Don Siegelman. He should have been pardoned by Obama a long time ago, and it's tragic that that hasn't occurred. But the current governor, Bob Bentley, who we talked about at length with Roger Shuler, the intrepid blogger who used to live in Alabama, the other day, well, Bentley is hanging on. He says he will not step down, but his girlfriend, who shares the claim with him that they never, you know, had a physical affair, well, she stepped down yesterday. Rebecca Mason submitted her resignation and was out of the Capitol by the end of the day yesterday. And there are more juicy details that you can read at Roger Shuler's blog, legalschnauzer.blogspot.com. And finally today, I want to commend The Intercept for keeping the heat on to expose the unconstitutional use of the Stingray surveillance system and its clones. And we get more detail on the 73-page opinion issued by the Maryland Court of Special Appeals that rejected claims from the state of Maryland, one that anybody who turned on their phone was voluntarily sharing their whereabouts with the police. I mean, that's cartoonish. And the opinion also harshly rebuked the city of Baltimore and its police department for trying to conceal their use of stingrays from the court. The judges stated, "Cell phone users have an objectively reasonable expectation that their cell phones will not be used as real-time tracking devices through the direct and active interference of law enforcement." In court testimony last April, a Baltimore detective revealed that the Baltimore PD had used stingrays more than 4,300 times and repeatedly failed to notify courts of their use in criminal cases. This decision upheld the order of a Maryland trial court that threw out evidence in the case of Karen Andrews, a suspect in a shooting of 2014. In order to locate him, police filed a pen register application, which has lower standards than a warrant and was the general practice when all phones were landline phones. The application explained that Baltimore police would collect data from Andrews' wireless service provider, and instead they secretly used an advanced stingray called Hailstorm without notifying the judge. And last year, the Baltimore Sun published a copy of the non-disclosure agreement that Baltimore signed with the FBI and Harris Corporation when they got the gadgets back in 2011. And this is flatly illegal, as the courts found. Judge Andrea Leahy said, "We perceive the state's actions in this case to protect the Hailstorm technology driven by a non-disclosure agreement to which it bound itself as detrimental to its position and inimical to the constitutional principles we revere." I want to underscore what she's saying here. This non-disclosure agreement that they claim prevents them from telling a judge that they used a stingray is an agreement that they're holding between themselves. And that is just absurd. And these are absurd times we live in, friends. Thanks for listening to my news and comment podcast, my ranting and raving. I appreciate you, and I hope you'll share this podcast all over the damn place. Put it up on Facebook. Click the like button. Click that wow button. Or just click. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Smile.